A woman's body in a suitcase, a man crouching behind a woman's car in a shopping centre car park, a rotting shark corpse on a beach. These are just some of the menacing images that haunt Evie Wilde's arresting new novel, The Bass Rock. Evie was born in the UK but spent much of her childhood in Australia. In 2014, she won the Miles Franklin Award for All the Birds Singing. And I'm so pleased to have Evie with me now. Hi, Evie.
Hi there.
Hey, Evie, can we talk about sharks?
Yes, please.
These have been a bit of an obsession for you, right?
Yeah, I think that has to do with seeing a bit of Australia as a kid and then living in London. I think you get your idea of scale really mixed up. So I think as a kid, I thought every shark was as big as a double-decker bus. And I also had this sort of idea that they were out to get you. They would, if only they had legs, they would they'd mount the pavement and come and get you in your bed.
That's terrifying.
It's a bit mad.
And in your novel, a pair of young boys, they're kind of obsessed with this rotting shark corpse on the shore. Did you ever get to see a shark up close like that?
I've seen a rotting one up close on that beach. Yeah, there was a big basking shark when I was a very small kid. I don't really remember it, but apparently I was all, you know, poor shark about it. So not in a very blood-curdling, exciting way, but my uncle in Australia used to live opposite a shark catcher. So when I was in Australia, I'd get taken out to pull up the lines. So that's probably where the paranoia and excitement came from, I think.
It's funny that you say paranoia and excitement, because is there a certain thrill in being afraid of something?
Oh, definitely. I mean, all of the shark books I had as a kid that would terrify me and give me nightmares, I had sort of favourite and most horrific pages that I knew were coming up and would terrify me to look at. And I would still, you know, it was like a ritual. You pass by all of the basking sharks and the whale sharks and the nice gentle sharks, and then you get to the great white leaping out of the water, and you know it's coming and it's just a book, but it kind of really dictated my sleep, I think, when I was a kid.
I think I'm starting to get a sense of the writer that you are now and this particular book, because there's this kind of gothic sensibility even that you might have had as a child.
Yeah, I think so. We're a family that likes to tell stories, and there's a lot of ghost stories in my family that you know, my Australian grandfather would tell them about, you know, the way he puts it, it's sort of coming face to face with a ghost, and he liked to tell a yarn. But my mum sort of has the same thing. She kind of a bit quieter, but she's got a really good sense of the uncanny and spookiness and all the senses when she sees a ghost anyway.
Sees a ghost. It's a factual thing. Do you believe in ghosts?
I don't. I'm an atheist, so I don't believe in afterlife, but I think people do see ghosts. I just think we haven't worked out what they are yet.
Wow, that's cool.
It's not very comforting.
But I get the sense that you're not into comforting, Evie, so that's okay.
Well, I think I find the gothic and you know, ghost stories and shark stories, I do find them sort of cozy, and I don't know, it's always where my brain goes to if I'm a bit tired or need some comfort. So who knows what that's about.
Evie, I'd like to talk to you about the Bass Rock. But before we do that, we probably need to know what the Red Heart campaign is. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Well, that's a campaign. It's a interactive map that an Australian journalist called Sherelle Moody came up with. And what she's done is she's put these red hearts all over a map of Australia. And when you click on them, it comes up with this little note about all of the information she could find on the woman or child that was murdered in that spot. Sometimes it's just a name, sometimes there's a photograph, and sometimes it has information about who killed her, you know, sort of more in-depth detail. But the thing that really struck me about it was the amount of unknown women all over Australia that that popped up.
And that was an inspiration for the book, right?
It was, even though the book is not set, none of it is set in Australia, it did start life as just thinking about, you know, how every day we walk in and out of these sort of death zones where, you know, somebody historically will have been murdered in most places, you know, there's, I mean, it's everywhere. And I started thinking about, what if we could cast like a hologram of all of the people who have historically been killed, just in our daily lives, how many women we would see. So it started as kind of thinking about holograms and ghosts.
Yeah, in fact, one of the characters in the book says, what if all the women that have been killed through history were visible to us all at once? Mm. And that's kind of what you're doing here.
Yeah. I think, so there's one of the strands which is set in the 16th century, and I was thinking about how at Halloween people dress up as ghosts, as witches, and there's this sort of cozy, fun idea of witch hunting and all that sort of thing. And it just sort of started to strike me that it hasn't really changed. We kind of look back at things like witch hunting as a like a sort of group madness that will never happen again. And actually the deaths from domestic violence are the same thing. They're just slightly differently shaped, I think.
In what way?
Well, in the way that if a man kills a woman at home and he's arrested, you know, the phrase is something like, it was an isolated incident with no further threat to the public, when actually it's a societal massive problem that is happening everywhere. Just like witch hunting, it's a kind of the same. Women are being killed for the same kind of reasons, which is living their lives too loudly or, you know, showing their anger. So yeah, it's any woman who slightly steps out of line is a witch, and I don't see a huge amount of difference between then and now.
So as you mentioned, there are multiple strands in this story. They all happen in the same place in Scotland, in the shadow of the Bass Rock, which is this, I guess, this kind of stone island in the Firth of Forth. Have you been to this place?
I have, yeah. I used to spend, I think, Easters there when I was a kid. And my father spent a lot of his childhood there. It's a sort of very, very British holiday destination. It's got like a... It used to have an outdoor swimming pool, which is very much not like icebergs in Sydney. It was kind of brown water and freezing cold and people in rubber caps, and so this really 1950s feel to the place. That the last time I went there was just before I had my son, when I was thinking about writing the book, and it really hasn't changed. I look at the photographs that my grandmother took there, and it looks the same to me. I'd see no difference at all, apart from the swimming costumes aren't woolen.
So I guess it's a great setting for a story where things are happening to women again and again and again through time.
Yeah, and the Bass Rock itself is this, it's a volcanic plug, and it's a really strange shape. And I like the idea that it sits there completely unmoving and unchanged, and all of this action happens in front of it over, you know, thousands of years.
So in the present day we meet Viv. She's this woman who strikes me as very lonely and lost. Can you introduce me to Viv?
So Viv is She's a very thinly veiled portrait of me, really.
Really?
She's someone who is sort of stuck in a bit of a cycle of a cross between self-loathing and boredom, I think. She does stuff that is not good for her, and not in a loud, exciting way. She's not going clubbing and taking loads of drugs. She's just quietly sitting and sort of mouldering in her flat. Viv was kind of, I wanted to write about the sort of incredible weight that women can feel with having to deal with the fear of, I guess the everyday fear of death is what it boils down to, that feeling when you're walking down a street and there's someone walking behind you and you kind of start to do a countdown of them overtaking you, or, you know, do you need to reach for your keys and, you know, hit them or something. And it's not like these are big moments for women. They're just everyday moments, or getting talked to on public transport, or getting rubbed against on public transport. They're small, seemingly small things that mount up and become like this big weight, I think. So Viv will have excellent intentions on her way home, and she'll be thinking she's gonna get in, she's gonna do some laundry, she's gonna clean her face, she's gonna make herself dinner and sit at the table and eat the dinner and read a book. And instead she'll come in and she'll sit on the sofa and not turn the lights on and not take her coat off and not take her boots off and just sit there. And I think that is a feeling that a lot of women get, of a sort of exhausted hopelessness at the end of just a very normal day.
And you talked about that kind of ongoing threat, that almost mundane threat that is just always around her. And I was anxious for Viv pretty much through the entire book, because when we first meet her, there is a man crouching behind her car in the car park. Mm. And Evie, I was just tense. Every time she had any interaction with a man, I worried for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Well, I think what I wanted to do was to kind of bring the everyday worries out onto the outside of Viv so you can see them. So then when she meets a kind of romantic interest, and I think you automatically sort of see where this is supposed to go in a rom-com kind of a way. He's supposed to bring her out of herself, and she's supposed to find him charming in his sort of grottiness and his loudness. And I really wanted to show some of that stuff and how harmful it is on the outside of, you know, rather than it all being kind of stuffed down and wadded down the woman's throat. And, you know, it's all about being polite and kind to people, because the worst thing ever is if a man tells you you've been rude to them by not engaging with them. It is a tense book, I think, but it's looking at the ways in which all of us are tense all of the time, if we let ourselves examine it at all.
In another storyline, we spend time with Ruth. She's actually Viv's step-grandmother. But in this story, Ruth has just moved to Scotland to a house just in front of the Bass Rock with her new husband, a man who already has two children from a previous marriage. How isolated is Ruth?
She's very isolated. She's quite recently, it happens not too long after the war, and she lost her brother in the war, who was her sort of great friend. And she, because she's the daughter in the family, not a huge amount of effort goes into looking after her. It's more about getting her married off. So Ruth is very, very based on my British grandmother. So she's, all of her timeline is correct. She lost the brother. She then married a man who was recently bereaved and had these two little boys to look after. And my grandmother was very, very alone and very smart, and didn't really do anything with her brain. So when I knew my grandmother, she was a gin alcoholic and chain smoker and depressive and hadn't been a great mother, had had three more kids and really had just, they all got sent off to boarding school at 8 years old and had a terrible time there. And, you know, sort of traditional British nightmare, basically. And so what I wanted to do was having, when my grandmother died, I inherited her photo albums, and there are all these little black and white pictures, a lot of them with the Bass Rock in the background, and they showed this version of my grandmother that I'd never known, which is this vital, sexy, alive woman who's got, you know, she's got a lot of hope. And I kind of wanted to write a version of my grandmother that was that version I didn't know, because all I knew her as was an alcoholic and not a good mother. And, you know, there was not a kind of bond between us, really. And it was about trying to imagine that, of course, there was more to it than I knew about.
It always strikes me as dangerous to mine your family's history for a novel. I mean, how does that play out in your family when you say, I'm writing our story?
Well, sort of in two different ways. One is that they think I'm writing a biography, and it's going to be like, you know, Ancestry.com or something. And it's all going to be accurate, and they want to give me lots of information, lots of really dry information. And so I spend most of the time when I'm writing a book reassuring them that it's not about them, while secretly taking all of the juiciest secrets. But the good thing is, what tends to happen is when you worry that you've really nailed someone, that you've got, you've just sort of taken your cousin and put them right in the middle of a novel, they never recognize themselves. They think everybody else but that person is them. So that's quite a relief.
Why don't they recognize themselves?
I suppose because the way you see yourself is never the way that other people see you. So unless I kind of give them the same name, I'm pretty much safe. And you know, I've had to do quite a lot of work with my family, saying this is very loosely based on just a timeline and none of you people, which is partly true and partly a complete lie.
Well, you've admitted it here on the book show. I saw a review of this book where someone called it your Me Too novel, which is probably a bit simplistic. But I did wonder if this was a book that was written in anger, Evie.
It's a really interesting one, because Me Too happened when I was about a third of the way through writing it. And what it did was it made me go, like these are all, this is all the same stuff. But I think, so it is, you know, in some ways it absolutely is. And it cemented a lot of the things that I was writing about. But I think in writing it, I became angry. I didn't set out to write an angry book or a confrontational book or anything like that. The way I write is, I think, on the page. So I had a newborn baby, and I was writing while he was asleep. So I just had to very quickly sit down and write, you know, whatever first popped into my head. And I think being very sleep deprived and being quite angry, because having a baby will make you angry and exhausted, and suddenly aware of how polarized the world becomes, I just would, those little, there are eight murders running through the book, and those kept coming up. I kept writing these women getting murdered, and it felt like it felt like being in the room with them when it was happening, and that kind of felt vaguely important, I think. And they changed a lot over the amount of time. So I think, yeah, to me it was, the more I wrote, the angrier I felt. And it became about noticing your own anger and noticing the deaths of people around you and the violences, and then the small violences, like going into a barber to get my son's hair cut, and there's a list on the wall of, you know, 12 reasons that beer is better than women, and it's supposed to be this like funny, cheeky thing, and you're just like, you just hate women. and you sort of notice it more when you're writing that sort of book.
Are you still angry?
Oh yeah. I think I'm still very much in the mood of the book. I think it was a really long book to write, and I haven't really stopped writing it in my head, I don't think. But I think it's a good thing. I think, you know, as women, we are taught that it's not acceptable to show anger. And I think the thing that's wonderful about Me Too is that it's so much anger worldwide, and it feels like it has this force and this sort of thrumming heat to it, which feels really important.
Evie, in the afterword of your book, you have a really interesting thank you. You thank the hosts of a couple of podcasts, including My Favourite Murder, which is a very popular podcast. It's got a couple of American presenters, and they basically pick a famous murder from history, usually of a woman, and they talk about it for an hour, and they kind of make jokes and they get serious. Why did you want to thank these podcast hosts?
I think what's incredible about My Favourite Murder and All Killer No Filler, which is the British version, is that the community that sprung up around them of women who all were fascinated by murder but all felt like they were creeps for being into it. And I think what My Favourite Murder does is it gives women permission to be angry and to be rude and therefore save themselves. I think there's a very sweary tagline that they have, which I won't repeat on air, but it's to do with politeness. And I just think the amount of cars I've got into or strange men I've spoken to when I didn't want to because I didn't feel that I was allowed to listen to my instinct and to follow that, and I had to be polite. And it gives women a real, I think, real agency that for some reason we hadn't just taken ourselves, that, you know, don't be polite. If they're a murderer, then you're getting away from being murdered. If they're not, they should understand that they are a threat, and they should go about their day. It won't make much difference to them. But for some reason, there's this huge heat around being rude as a woman, and they are just, you know, they've made this community of people who sort of look out for each other and encourage each other to listen to their kind of inner voice telling them this is a bad situation and to get out of it.
But also to kind of, I don't know what the word is, but to kind of relish in some of the gory details of these crimes. I wondered, Evie, if part of it, the joy or the interest that you have in listening to those podcasts, is in some way related to the kid who liked reading the shark books and seeing, you know, those images of someone being attacked by a shark.
Well, I suppose it's the same, you know, it's all about survival, isn't it? I wanted to look right down the shark's throat so that I would know what to do when it came at me, I think. And I think the more informed you are about these things, the more weapons you've got in your arsenal. I don't know. It's not enjoyment for, so the podcast is kind of, it's very funny and enjoyable to listen to, but there are definite moments where you'll be listening to it and you just have to stand still.
Yeah.
And it will take your breath away. But I just think when women talk about this kind of stuff, then they get some power back from it.
Well, Evie, I really enjoyed this book. We've made it sound very grim, but there's lots to enjoy. There's moments of laughter, but it is so powerful. And when I finished it, I kind of had to pause and I made a noise. I kind of, oh, when I read the last sentence. So thank you so much. It's been really wonderful to talk to you today.
Thank you.
And Evie's book, The Bass Rock, is published by Vintage.